Although he is best known for his photos of New York's poor immigrants, Jacob Riis was also an important progressive-era social reformer and journalist. In a new book called Rediscovering Jacob Riis, Exposure, Journalism, and Photography in the Turn of the Century New York, Bonnie Yochelson and Daniel Citrom explore Riis's controversial life and work. The book is published by the New Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome them to the show. Hi.
Hi there.
Jacob Riis was a muckraking police reporter, and he wrote one of the most important books of his time, How the Other Half Lives, in 1890. Why then does he turn out to have been a controversial figure? Is there a side to Jacob Riis, Daniel, that we're only learning about more recently, or we've overlooked in the past?
Well, I think part of the thing that Bonnie and I were trying to do in this book was to do some real historical digging and to look at Riis as he was in the specific place and time of New York in the Gilded Age, and also to look at his practice of photography, which he's probably best known for. And we were trying to, in some ways, complicate the story and try to situate Riis, as I say, in the specifics of time and place and in the context of what was happening in New York at that day. And in that context, Riis was doing some things that nobody had done before. And it's also the case that Riis's reputation has evolved over time. So we were trying to get back to what he actually did, who he actually was.
Because he hung out with a lot of the rich and famous, and I wouldn't have imagined that about him. But also he was to some degree involved with the eugenics thinking.
Well, to back up a second, I would say this, that you know, Riis is a complicated character. He is a police reporter. He's an aspiring photographer. He is a publicist. He is an evangelical Christian. He's a popular entertainer. He's all those things mixed up together. And in terms of the audience for his work, when he begins taking pictures and creating this sort of slideshow, this what I call vaudeville of reform that he toured around for a couple of years with before How the Other Half Lives, his audiences are generally well-to-do, genteel Christians, philanthropic types, who he was appealing to, really throwing down the gauntlet really to their conscience, so to speak. And so presenting these pictures and giving his illustrated lecture was somewhat shocking to people, also entertaining, and something very, very new.
Bonnie, were you a curator at the Museum of the City of New York when it received the Jacob Riis archives?
No, it came to the museum in the 1940s. Alexander Aland was a photographer himself who discovered the pictures and printed them and mounted an exhibition in 1948 called The Battle of the Slum, working with a curator there, Grace Mayer, who was my personal hero. The pictures were subsequently given to the museum, and I was a curator there in the late 80s and the early 90s. And there had been a lot written about Riis's photographs, and it was very confusing for me to try to figure out what these photographs meant. I mean, I was trained as an art historian and was used to working on photographs in the collection, for example, like those of Bernice Abbott. And Riis was a professional writer whose collection was a potpourri of negatives and lantern slides and no prints to show. And so I got involved in an access and preservation grant with a collection and realized that if I wanted to do any new interpretation on this, I really needed to work with somebody who understood what it meant to be a journalist, who understood what crime was about and politics was about in the turn of the century, and that's why I reached out to Dan to collaborate with him.
But what was confusing? Were the photographs not always... Did they not always work as photographs? Were they? How did he think of his photographs? Was he? Did he think of himself as a photographer or someone who was simply documenting the inequities of his time?
He didn't think of the photographs as valuable in and of themselves. For example, he did not save them. He kept all of his papers. He annotated them. They were given to the Library of Congress upon his death, and he didn't even think to save his photographs. It was Aland in the 1940s. Riis died in 1914. Who found them working with Riis's son, and that was very significant to me because Reese was basically saw these pictures as integral to his argument, as part of a show, as part of an argument, something that he used that was only meaningful in the context of his words. And so, but the pictures have been reinterpreted by other people since then, including even John Sarkowski, the curator at the Museum of Modern Art, who's held them up as very important modern works of photographic art. And so that was what I felt I had to wrestle with.
So, Daniel, he just simply thought of these photographs as illustrations for his lectures.
Well, he had been writing about New York for quite a while. He started in 1877 as a reporter for the New York Tribune. And by the middle 1880s, he had begun to focus on the worsening problem of tenement house life in New York City. But he was frustrated by sort of the inability to really communicate to people how bad things really were using simply words. So in 1888, Reese reads about this new development of flash photography and sort of sees this as a way for him to begin taking pictures in places with no natural light that would allow him to really bring the story home, with a bigger impact.
Was he influenced by other photographers? How did he teach himself to do this?
No. He contacted two serious amateur photographers and asked their help with the technical side. And they produced together apparently 100 slides. And it was through them that they were interested in lantern slides. They were interested in that technology, which was new at the time, of projecting an image in a dark room. And they arranged for his first lecture, which was at the New York Society of Amateur Photographers. And it was the lecture got enormous press, well beyond the amateur photography audience, which Reese kept and in his scrapbook. That's how we know about it. And that's what launched this shift in his career from being a daily crime reporter to being a professional social reformer.
Well, when I look at some of these images, maybe some of the lousy photographs have disappeared, but I see very powerful images, the kind of powerful images that serious professional photographers like Lewis Hine must have been influenced by.
Well,
so was he just a natural photographer, or were the subjects so compelling that I could have taken those pictures and gotten some great pictures?
I don't want to sound like a debunker of the pictures themselves. I love these pictures. They're some of the strongest pictures, and they're an incredible document that we have, unique document of really dramatic historical moment when thousands and thousands of immigrants were being forced into living under with absolutely no space, no light, no air, in the Lower East Side of New York in the 1880s and 90s. So the pictures are extremely powerful and extremely still have the power to shock even in us with all the pictures we've seen of war and of poverty in the 100 years since. They're extremely effective, but where I had to try to sort out in my own mind, which I hope is compelling, is that Reese wasn't a composer of images as we think of today as a professional photographer. And many of his most famous pictures, for example, Bandit's Roost, which shows some toughs in an alley off of Mulberry Street, he didn't even take that image. That was taken for him by the amateurs who he hired. And some of the most powerful ones that are still among the most famous, for example, 5 Cents a Spot, which shows a rooming house, an illegal rooming house on Bayard Street.
Which is beautifully composed, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. That image, which shows maybe over a dozen people in the corner of a room who have been shocked by this flash powder that went off in their faces, works as a modern composition, but really communicates expressively the sort of chaos and filth and dehumanizing conditions, but was taken in a completely dark room, and it was probably only after the picture was taken that that Reese even knew exactly what he was photographing. So there's a strong argument against composition in the modern sense, but we ourselves, I certainly wouldn't want to try to limit anyone's under, you know, emotional reaction to the to these incredibly powerful images by suggesting that he wasn't carefully composing as, say, a Dorothea Lange did in the 1930s or a Gene Smith did in the 1950s or 60s.
My guests are Bonnie Jochelson and Daniel Citrom, who have collaborated on a book called Rediscovering Jacob Riis. It's published by the New Press. Well, so, Daniel, this is kind of like those commercials we see on television for sending help to starving children in Africa.
Well, it's interesting you mention that because I've been brooding about this. I try to argue in my essay in the book that Riis is a transitional figure. I mean, he's looking backwards in some ways toward 19th century traditions of police reporting, sunshine and shadow guidebooks to the mysteries of the city, the reports of charity organizations, that sort of thing. But he's also looking forward to the 20th century. I think he's the first muckraker. He's the first person to use photography to try to, publicize conditions and make change, social change. And he also, I think, represents the beginning of a visual turn in American culture, which I still see in the reference you just made. That is, almost any attempt at reform, at stirring people's conscience, is trying to create political and social change, now has a very big visual component. Riis, in some ways, is the guy that started that.
Now, you say that it also came out of police reporting.
Yes.
In what way?
Riis was a police reporter, and in the 19th century, what that meant was, an education, really, in the underside of the city, because covering the police department was about a lot more than simply covering crime, catching of criminals, and so on. It was about really learning the realities of the streets, the life of the tenements. Police were responsible for a lot of social welfare activities. That's how Riis learned the city. And it's also where I think, as I said before, he really makes a commitment to focusing on tenement house situation. And, the figures are really staggering. By 1880, you've got something like 600,000 New Yorkers living in about 24,000 tenements. You've got 3,000 kids dying every year in New York from diarrhea alone. The material conditions of the city were appalling. And there's an ironic joke in the title of How the Other Half Lives, because Riis writes about this. He says he's really talking about the other three quarters. New York had 1.6 million people in 1890. About 1.2 million lived in tenements. Not all of them were as terrible as some of the ones depicted in his books, but most of them were pretty bad.
And How the Other Half Lives was a bestseller.
It was a very popular book.
Did people find it shocking? Did they not know this was going on?
Well, it's interesting that the people who are depicted in the book and in the photographs are not the audience for the book. I mean, the audience for the book is largely this sort of genteel, Christian, middle-class reform audience. Riis inspires a whole generation of progressive reformers, people like Francis Perkins, Fiorello LaGuardia. A lot of people felt themselves really seared by reading that book. It did sell very well. I think his best-selling book, though, was his autobiography, The Making of an American, published in 1902.
And we should point out that he was an immigrant as well.
Yes.
So, but he was not an immigrant who faced the same problems that these immigrants that he documented did?
Briefly, what I would say is that Riis comes to the United States in 1870 from Denmark. He's about 20 years old, and he does bring with him certain advantages that most immigrants did not have. For example, he had a working knowledge of English. He had a skill. He was a carpenter, a burning ambition to succeed. As a sort of Northern European Protestant immigrant, he had certain other advantages as well compared to, let's say, somebody from Italy or a Jew or what have you.
Who was he inspired by? Because you say that he kind of started the muckraking movement. We have a whole bunch of other people who come along, Frank Norris and Upton Sinclair. But
Lincoln Steffens, who apprenticed himself to Riis, talks about Riis a lot as an inspiration. Who were Riis's influences? It's interesting that as a kid, he apparently read a lot of Dickens when he read English back in Denmark. And then when he comes to the United States...
He is a fantastic storyteller.
Yeah.
I mean, there's very much that quality.
We have his speeches?
I'm sorry?
We have copies of his speech?
Oh, in the writings, I think.
Yes. He wrote so much. I mean, you can't even read all of Riis's writings because he was writing 10 books and a regular column for the paper for almost 30 years. Yeah. And also writing for national magazines. And they're very, very repetitive, but he's a fantastic storyteller.
And he does cite some interesting influences on him in his autobiography. For example, Felix Adler, the guy who founded the Society of Ethical Culture. You know, it was a big influence on Reese because Adler had been an agitator for reforming tenement houses. And, you know, one of my favorite lines, as one historian put it, only in New York City could the founder of social Christianity be a reformed Jew. Mm-hmm. That's Adler. And there were a couple of other people like that. But I don't think anybody put together the kind of combination of approaches that we associate with Reese. So in that sense, he really had no influences. He made something up very, very new.
And during his time, he would not have been thought of as a photographer. It's only later that we've come to associate him with photographs first, and only later that people started thinking of him as an art photographer as well.
Yes, that basically evolved from largely through the work of Alexander Land, who did this landmark show at the Museum of the City of New York in 1948.
Well, is after the WPA photographers and a whole style had been established.
Yes. One of the things that there's been always sort of two constituencies for Reese. One is the kind of reform constituency, as Dan mentioned. People like Francis Perkins, LaGuardia, you know, spoke glowingly of him as an influence by reading How the Other Half Lives, with no attention to the pictures, just to the argument. Robert Moses also, so that we have the Jacob Riis Park, Jacob Riis, you know, all the housing. The housing project name for mm-hmm. him. There's this whole reform tradition that he belongs to. But it wasn't until Aland's work and this 1948 exhibition that the photographs became known through Aland's prints from the negatives. I mean, he cleaned them up. He was a fantastic craftsman.
But he found the negatives.
He found the negatives, and he made new prints. And it was those 50 images that were shown at the Museum of the City of New York that started the story of Reese as a photographer. And then in 1970s, he published a book that was published by Aperture and that was became a classic within the photo literature of the time, and it's actually still in print. And so it was through that Reese's photographs became very well known and appreciated.
Bonnie Okelson and Daniel Citrom will be giving a talk and signing books tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Museum of the City of New York on 5th Avenue and 103rd Street, the museum that has this amazing collection of Jacob Riis's photographs. Bonnie Okelson is formerly curator of prints and photographs at the Museum of the City of New York. She now teaches at the School of Visual Arts and has written about other great photographers like Bernice Abbott. Daniel Citrom is professor of history at Mount Holyoke College, the author of Media and the American Mind, and co-author of Out of Many, A History of American People. Their book, Rediscovering Jacob Riis, is published by the New Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you
very
much.